Religious profession, like any other human contracts and vows, may be invalid. It may be invalid in as many ways as there are conditions which are necessary in order to the validity of it. Sometimes religious profession may be invalid by the law of nature, and sometimes by ecclesiastical law, sometimes from an internal defect, and sometimes from an external defect. On the part of a religious order, four conditions are required in order to the validity of religious profession. These are, 1, pontifical approbation of the community as a religious order, 2, lawful power in the superior, who in name of the order receives the profession, 3, his internal consent, and 4, his sufficient external acceptance. On the part of the religious also, there are several necessary conditions in order to the validity of his profession. He must have attained the age which is required by law. 2, had a full year of probation, and be free from every such bond as would by law hinder the validity of religious profession. Now, I'm continuing here on page 91. Sometimes religious profession is null and void in such a way that it can never be rectified or made valid. This will be the case if it has been made in accordance with a rule and in a community which has not been approved by the Apostolic See as constituting a religious state. Even if such a body should subsequently be approved, this will not be a ratification of previous profession. Subsequently, profession will be religious profession which is made for the first time. And going now to page 92. If the reception of the religious habit was null, no part of the term of probation which was founded upon it can be reckoned in order to complete the year of probation, which is necessary to the validity of profession. There must be a new and valid reception, and therefore an entire year of probation before profession. If the reception to the religious habit was valid, and the profession was null as having been made before the end of the term of probation, the whole time of perseverance in religion under the idea of valid profession will in no way avail towards completion of the year of probation. During that time, the person was not on probation. It was not, therefore, a time of noviceship. He who has been invalidly professed can lawfully refuse to ratify his profession. He is free to abandon the habit without, in conscience, incurring the ecclesiastical penalties of apostasy or excommunication, since his invalid profession did not constitute him a religious, nor did it bind him to perseverance. On page 186, Father Humphrey gives us a good explanation of all jurisdiction coming down from a true pope when he writes, "A monarchical government is, according to Aristotle and to St. Thomas, of all governments the most perfect. Christ himself taught this when he willed that in his church there should be perfect monarchy. Nature itself declares it by admitting one only supreme prince of the universe, namely his divine majesty. The religious state, by reason of its perfection, specially demands monarchy. It requires not only one governor, but also one head, who should be one person." And then on the bottom of this page and on the next page, he speaks about jurisdiction. Some of what he writes says, "Among nuns, there does not exist any spiritual jurisdiction. Nuns as women are incapable of possessing jurisdiction. The ancient monks were not as a rule clerics, and no laymen, however holy they may be, are capable of ecclesiastical jurisdiction. Although it is not necessary that ecclesiastical jurisdiction should exist in a superior of the same sex to order, ecclesiastical jurisdiction over every religious order must nevertheless exist in someone prelate of the church. He is by reason of this jurisdiction the prelate of that order. There cannot exist any state in the church without that state's being subject to the jurisdiction of the prelates and the pastors of the church." On page 188, it reads, "It does not follow from the institution or approbation of a religious order that it should possess jurisdiction. Religious orders do not possess jurisdiction in virtue of common law. It is conferred on them by way of special concession. And that is all I am going to read for now from this book by Father Humphrey. And now I turn to a book titled The Spirit of Sacrifice, The Life of Sacrifice in the Religious State, from the original of a priest who spells his name G-I-R-A-U-D, a missionary priest of Our Lady of La Salette, revised by Reverend Herbert Thruston, S.J., second edition, published by Bensikon Brothers in 1905, as a Unique Co-op State by Remy Laforte, and an Imprimatur by John M. Farley. And turning to page 235, chapter 2, on the religious vows. By the religious vows is meant the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience taken in an institute approved by the Holy See. These three vows form the essence of the religious life. The religious life has been defined as, quote, a permanent and fixed manner of life approved by the Church, in which the faithful pledge themselves to strive after perfection by means of the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, taken in accordance with the rule of the order, unquote. 1. It is said to be a fixed and permanent manner of life approved by the Church. Without the approbation of the highest ecclesiastical authority, what warranty would the faithful possess for the excellence of the most perfect rule of an order to all appearance most fervent? The Church cannot be deceived in her estimate of the end proposed by a congregation and the means whereby they propose to attain that end. Skipping over paragraphs 2 and 3, we come down to paragraph 4. Part of it reads, after the priesthood, there is nothing more holy, more sublime than the religious life. It is of divine institution. Our Lord himself was its founder, and it was followed in the earliest ages of Christianity. To remind us again that it is of divine institution, just as are the sacraments, and to once more emphasize the fact that Epikai can never be invoked to change you to get around the eternal law of God, the natural law, or the divine positive law, as well as human invalidating laws. Epikai can never be invoked for things that pertain to the external forum. And so with this background information, which I, your crazy commentator, broadcasting here from Crazy Radio in Religiousville, USA.
This next section about Crazy Radio may not be prudent to even put in here, but I'll probably do it later on. I think at this time I will dub into here a tape I made for Bishop George Musey on March 13th, 1986. The reason this tape was made was because I had been talking to George Musey on the telephone and asked him if anyone in the congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe, had made a year of novitiate. And we discussed the religious vows, and he thought everybody had vows. And so I made this tape to show that no one made a religious profession. And since this is what we've just discussed recently on this tape of what is it all about, I will try and dub in now this tape about the religious life.
Your Excellency, Most Reverend Bishop George Musey. Today is Thursday, March 13th, 1986. And a very short time ago, I finished a telephone conversation with you. And you asked me to send you a copy of the conversation which I was taping. And so together with the telephone conversation tape, I'm now going to try and explain on this tape in much more detail why I do not believe at this day in my life that anyone who belonged to the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe, founded by Bishop Francis Schuckardt, has ever made a religious profession. The month of August 1983, my natural brother James Henry, known in the religious congregation as Brother Felix Marie, and myself, as you know now, have left that congregation. And as I was saying, during that month of August, just after I had left, we went on a retreat, and I made a tape, which I termed the five-hour tape because it lasted about that long. And at the end of that tape, I had made the statement that I still believe we had religious vows. Do you have a copy of that tape? I'm not sure if it's clear enough to hear it, but I sent that to you. Anyway, with this tape, and I wish to explain why I've changed my views, and I no longer believe that we ever made a religious profession and have the religious vows, as I believe I mentioned in the phone conversation this morning. I had written to Most Reverend Sylvester W. Trinan, the Bishop of Boise, Idaho, and I wrote this letter on September 11th, 1984, and he replied on September 14th, 1984 to some of my questions. And on the bottom of this letter he answers, "I am not familiar with the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. If that is Shuckart's group, then it would not be recognized by Rome. Private vows made by members could easily be dispensed by the proper authority." And then later, when different things were happening, I got in contact with Bishop Sylvester W. Trinan. And on October 5th, 1985, I had this phone conversation with him. And this is not very clear to begin with, or too loud. I hope it will pick up enough here for you to be able to hear it, the essential part of it. So now I will dub in to hear that part of our phone conversation that deals with this last paragraph of Bishop Trinan's letter to me of September 14th.
I was just wondering how you relived that, because if I was thinking about it, to give obedience to Bishop Shuckart and his lawful successors, which none of it could be done anymore because he was not, he has no lawful successors, really. And it was just really an illicit vow in a way. That would be all three vows of poverty, chest, obedience, son, and family are binding. One of the main things is, at the bottom of your letter, you also answer, "I am not familiar with the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. That is Shuckart's group, and that it would not be recognized in Rome. By the vows made by members, it needs to be dispensed by the proper authority." Did you not know anything about the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe? Did Bishop Francis ever contact you with his lay brother before you started that community?
No, I don't think so. He started that community without any knowledge of mine, and without any permission. I think I heard about it. I would visit up there at Colonel Lane once in a while, and I met the brothers there, and I met sisters, but I never was acquainted with the constitution that they had or anything like that. He didn't seek any permission from me for that.
Did he ever talk to you in person, that you remember?
Yes, he did any time.
Yes.
Yes, I met him one time up here in Cottonwood when he was having a
seminar. But at that time, he did not request anything about starting a congregation, did he?
No. And then I tried to go to see him in Colonel Lane several times. The one time I got into the place where he was staying, but the lady there, he said to me, he's not feeling well. He's in the back room here, but he's sick and not receiving any visitors. And I told her that, I would just like to at least say hello. But I didn't get in there.
Did he ever write to you or in any way seek permission to move over to Coeur d'Alene, since he used to be in the Bellevue area over in Seattle? Did he ever ask to come to Idaho?
Yeah, I think at the time when he was working in Cottonwood here, he mentioned to me that he would like to head to all his headquarters in the Coeur d'Alene, and at that time there was nothing apparently wrong with what he was doing. But then I said, well, I can't prevent anybody from coming into any town to land and to talk to people and to conduct little seminars. I can tell them I don't want you here, but that wouldn't prevent them from coming.
Well, did Father, well, at that time, Brother Dennis, your car never talk to you or seek any kind of permission?
I did. He was right at the house. I talked to him for some time, but he didn't ask any permission at all, many times.
Well, they also told me that they worked with the Father Lacy, you know, as kind of the spiritual director and so on. Did you know about that?
Well, at the very beginning when they came, and when they mentioned Francis was on way out, like he turned afterwards. At first, he just looked like he was a worker for the Blue Army. And the Blue Army was not condemned or anything. And it was only until after the Blue Army expelled him that Francis began to show what he was really all about. So it was a gradual thing. So I think at first Father Lacy had kind of said, well, he had this Catholic man who was trying to spread devotion to our Blessed Mother. And so that was as far as that went. But then later on, when it became very evident that he starting with a disorder without permission. Then the Blue Army expelled him and told him that he had no standing in the Blue Army anymore at all. And then gradually, month by month, year by year, he began to take these more outside the church positions.
And so now we have heard the Most Reverend Sylvester W. Tran, Bishop of Boise, was ordained June 11, 1946, appointed May 19, 1962 to the Diocese of Boise, and consecrated July 25, 1962. And I give this date from the National Catholic Directory as to when Bishop Sylvester W. Tran was assigned to the Diocese of Boise, Idaho. And we know that all of the state of Idaho was under the one diocese out of Boise, to remind us that at the time that Bishop Francis Shepard began the religious congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe, when he himself was still just a lay brother, in the year about 1967, that Sylvester W. Tran was already the bishop whose jurisdiction Francis Shepard should have been under. And here then we have the words of Bishop Sylvester W. Tran, the Bishop of Boise, Idaho, that Shuckhart, Moshe Coyne, or anyone else has ever approached him to seek permission to found the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. And certainly, Bishop Tran never gave any kind of approbation to the Congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. And even if Bishop Sylvester W. Tran had given any kind of approbation, it would not have been blessed in the eyes of God, because by that time, 1967 or later, Bishop Tran himself was already excommunicated for signing the decrees and documents of Vatican Council II and promoting it throughout the Diocese of Boise, Idaho. But those facts being what they are, let me now turn to the conference bulletin that was put out in 1981. For the 10th anniversary of the consecration of Bishop Francis K. Shepard. And during this conference of 1981, they put out two different bulletins. One of them shows the coat of arms of Bishop Shepard on its front cover. The other one shows Bishop Shepard kneeling at the feet of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe, with different pictures around the edge and so on. And I turn now to the third page of the bulletin that has the coat of arms in the front and read here that it, by 1967, he, meaning Francis Schaeffer, had traveled all over the world lecturing on the message of Fatima and the evil of communism, informing a little prayer and study group he called, quote, Fatima Cells, unquote, Our Lady's means of fortifying her children against the rampant heresies and moral decadence of the time. As Satan prepared his fatal blow, our Blessed Mother decided she had had enough. It was time for her to raise up a little army of valiant soldiers to meet this foe head on. During the spring of that year, Bishop Francis was lecturing in Europe. One day he knelt at the shrine of Mary, Immaculate Queen of the Universe, where Our Lady had been appearing outside of Paris to a devout laywoman. He promised Our Lady that if she would help him open an apostolic center in a small community of oblates to operate it by August 5th, Feast of Our Lady of the Snows, a center and community dedicated to the spreading of her peace plan from heaven, he would name them after her, Mary, Immaculate Queen of the Universe. And that's into the reading for now, because this tells us then that the congregation was only getting started by August 5th, 1967. And reading on the bottom of this third page and flipping over, it says, 50 years since the miracle of the Son of Fatima, Mary's little band made their first religious vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience on the feast of the Most Holy Rosary in 1967. So it should be obvious from what I just read that those religious vows, as they're called in this bulletin, are not really religious vows, they're only private vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience made to your lay brother, Francis Schaeffer. Now this is important because of what I'm going to try and explain later, that for religious vows to be vowed, they must be public vows. And also keep in mind that no lay person has any ecclesiastical jurisdiction, as I will try to give the reference sources later on. And at this point, Brother Francis Schaeffer was not even a cleric, but only third order Carmelite. And now I flip over in this bulletin to the sixth page, where it gives the calendar of graces. And in 1972 it reads, His Excellency gives Episcopal approbation to the religious congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe. Now why does here His Excellency Bishop Francis Schaeffer have to give Episcopal approbation if they already had received Episcopal approbation from Bishop Sylvester W. Trinan? It will be important to remember the dates of some of these events, and it will probably be necessary to play the tape several times to get everything together properly if you have not studied these things out yet. But I say it's important to remember these dates because of any information we're going to try and give you about the necessity of having a year novitiate before someone can make a valid religious profession and so on. From this bulletin, the calendar of graces in 1974 reads, Bishop opens new sisters cloister novitiate in the fall, sends first group of sisters to City of Mary Convent of the Annunciation. So let us take note that here in the year 1974, Bishop opened the sisters cloister novitiate in the fall, and in the year 1975, Feast of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the first final vows ceremony for the sisters at the City of Mary, August 22nd. On the same year, 1975, reads, Bishop founds and opens the Immaculate Heart of Mary Brothers Cloister Novitiate in the fall in the hills of northern Idaho. And the very next year, 1976, it reads, Feast of the Holy Name of Mary, Father Dennis Philomena Marie, Father Mary James, and Brother Michael Marie take final vows at the City of Mary, September 12th. Take note of these dates again, and I also will let you know that the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe does not have a real rule, nor any constitution. All they basically had to follow as the ruling constitutions were the 25 norms. And under the 13th norm it reads, 2-year novitiate, first year with promises, second year with vows, followed by temporary 3-year profession. when Francis Shepard was starting up the congregation. Some of them took one-year vows, and I believe later took two-year vows and then five-year vows. And he changed the norms around somewhat, and then it became more stabilized. But here, even in the norms, says a two-year novitiate, followed by temporary three-year profession. And we read in the bulletin how they made religious profession only a year after the novitiate was open. And when the first cloister novitiate was open for the sisters, I believe that Robert Mother Mary Teresa was the novice mistress, and so certainly she was not making her canonic a year of novitiate. And at the end, her sisters who made their vows in 1975, supposedly a final profession, had not made that year of novitiate, although the cloistered convent had now opened, and very few of them, if any, made that year of novitiate. Some of them made it in later years. The same way with the brothers. When it was opened in the fall of 1975, Father Mary James was the novice master and the superior and so on. And before we go on much further, maybe this is the place to clarify the fact that you've noticed, but now I've been speaking of these religious, as some think them to be, by the religious names of Father Dennis Philomena Marie, Father Mary James, Sister Mary Teresa, or whatever the religious name was given to them, because they're known by that name. Although in reality, in God's sight, I do not believe that they have ever made a religious profession. I use that religious name though simply because I think it would cause less confusion rather than to use names such as Robert DuCoyne or Dennis McGillivray. And I don't even know the sisters' names in secular life for the most part. One thing I want you to be aware of when you talk to certain other members of CMRI, they will maybe try and tell you that they made their year of novitiate, but they called the House of Formation over on Silver Beach. Once was called St. Martin de Porres House of Formation, one under different titles and names. But that was when the congregation was starting up, and there was really no novitiate. It was only where the brothers lived together. I don't know what the sisters called their house of formation, but the reason I mention this is people like Father Louis Marie will make reference maybe that that was their year of novitiate simply because they had cold weather and many inconveniences, living in tight quarters. It was not comfortable. In other words, it was more of a penitential type house, and so they simply called it the year of novitiate. And certainly Father Dennis Philomena May could not have been making a year of novitiate in any lawful way, because he was at that time the one giving our formation classes and supposedly the superior and giving all the directions. And you cannot be a superior and subject at the same time as he quotes in his letter, I think, of June 21st, 1984. And it is not that Bishop Shepard and Father Dennis Philomena Marie were not aware of these things. I state that because now I will read to you from a letter dated March 7th, 1971, Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. It is written by a woman who was supposedly a religious sister of this congregation, Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe, when it was first founded. Her name was really Miss Anne Frances Kitko. And she addressed this letter to Mr. Dennis DuCoyne and Mr. Francis Shepard, and it explains the reasons why she separated herself from the community that Francis Shepard started up. The first part of the letter opens, "Dear brothers in Christ, praise be Jesus and Mary, now and forever. At the time I left the, quote, Oblate Sisters, unquote, I gave Sister Teresa three principal reasons for so doing. One, the fact of unconsecrated hands presuming to handle our Lord and God in the most blessed sacrament, as you both have distributed the Holy Eucharist to communicants and administered Eucharistic benediction. Two, the fact that you have... And then she goes on to explain why Mr. Dennis Coyne and Mr. Francis Shepgart should not have been distributing Holy Communion and offering benediction. But skipping over that part of the letter, I would like to come down to the section where she speaks about the religious life. And it reads here on page 4, as regards your position as superior of the religious order, the Church, in her great wisdom, has established definite procedures for the founding of new religious orders since, by the grace of her infallible guide, the Holy Ghost, she knows that abuses and excesses are inevitable unless this guidance is heeded. There are many canon laws which could be quoted here, but rather than that, the following is, I think, a beautiful exposition of this facet of Catholic teaching and practice from the Elements of Religious Life of Father Humphrey S.J., pages 40 to 43. Quote, according to the present law and usage of the Church of God, it is not possible for a true religious state to exist except in a religious body which has been approved by the Church. Unquote. And she inserts here then, hence, unless you or any other, quote, order, unquote, has official ecclesiastical approbation, no one in that order can consider himself or herself a religious, and certainly no one in that, quote, order, unquote, can presume to be a, quote, religious superior, unquote, in any sense. End of her insertion, and now back to the book from Father Humphrey. Quote, the approbation of the Church includes two things. One of these belongs to the understanding or to a judgment of the understanding. The other is more properly an operation of the will. To approve a religious community in the first way is, after sufficient examination, to make an internal judgment and externally and authoritatively to declare that the mode of life of that community is holy, that it is free from all error and superstition, that in its end and in the means which it proposes, it is a manner of life which is tending toward perfection, and that therefore it is worthy of erection to the religious state. By this approbation, nothing is conferred on the Institute. That which the Institute already possesses is simply made known. To approve in the second way is efficaciously to create or erect the community into an ecclesiastical and truly religious state. It is to this public and authoritative approbation that by the new order is proposed to the universal Church as a system to be imitated or embraced and followed, that theologians refer when they say that the sovereign pontiff cannot err in his approving of religious bodies. He cannot err in authoritatively declaring that its mode of life is good and holy, and that it is a fitting means towards the end of acquiring perfection. This approbation is, as it were, a canonization, by which the Institute has publicly and authoritatively set forth as holy. The necessity for approbation does not arise from canon law alone. It is founded in the law of nature. I'm interrupting Ms. Kitchko's letter here to draw special attention to this fact that this approbation is founded in the law of nature. I'm drawing attention to this fact to remind everyone that being founded in the law of nature, there is therefore no way that Epikaya can be invoked to obtain this necessary approbation, as is very well explained in a very important book titled The History, Nature, and Use of Epikaya in Moral Theology by the Reverend Lawrence Joseph Riley, A.B., S.T.L., which has an imprimatur by Richard Jacob Cushing, D.D., Archbishop of Boston, in 1948 is the copyright. In this book on the history, nature, and use of Epikaya by Father Riley, he gives the quotations of all the main theologians in the Church, none of whom, in this case, are opposed to St. Thomas Aquinas, of which he gives a large section on him. And in this Article 3, Father Riley reminds us that Epikaya may not be applied to precepts of the natural law.
And I'm stressing this because this is what Francis Schaeffer and Dennis Chacon have told people, from what I've understood and heard myself, that they had woke up Pattaya to give their approbation to this Islamic religious congregation. Now let me go on with this letter from Ms. Kiko. A religious body with a mode of common life cannot be instituted by means of the substantial vows of religion alone, without the addition of certain observances which give to that body its special character, and that which is added by merely human action, peril of error is always imminent. To avoid this, the authoritative approbation of the Church is necessary. The propagation of religious bodies were free to private individuals. Many errors might easily be introduced, and the faithful might be deluded into embracing a mode of life which was either prejudicial to their salvation, or was a hindrance to their perfection, or at least was in no way a real means towards perfection. It so happened in the time of Innocent III, certain heretics who were called poor men of Lyons, or Waldensians, invented a superstitious mode of life. They endeavored also to introduce it as a religious state. Innocent III therefore decreed that no religious order should in future be erected without the approbation of the sovereign pontiff. Approbation in some fashion is always from the beginning of the Church of Christ necessary in order to the introduction into that church of a new religious body. Besides speculative approbation, by which the usefulness and the excellence of a religious body is declared, there is also necessary in order to the institution and erection of that body, a practical approbation. By this practical approbation, there is given to a religious congregation or to its superiors power to accept in the name of Christ and to constitute in a true religious state those persons who offer themselves for profession of that manner of life which it embodies. Unquote from her book on the elements of the religious life of Father Humphrey, except then she gives another quote from this book on page 205. No layman, however holy they may be, are capable of ecclesiastical jurisdiction. There cannot exist any state in the Church without that state being subject to the jurisdiction of the prelates and pastors of the Church. And that's all I'm going to read then from this letter dated March 7th, 1971 by Ms. Frances Kitko to Mr. Dennis Chacon and Mr. Francis Shepard. But I would ask you to note again the date, March 7th, 1971, and Francis Shepard was not ordained to the priesthood until October 31st, 1971, and consecrated bishop the next day. And that's why, as it says here, no laymen, however holy they may be, are capable of ecclesiastical jurisdiction, to show that Brother Francis Shepard had no ecclesiastical jurisdiction to found the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe. But because I found this book on the elements of the religious life with Father Humphrey very informative and important, I obtained a copy of it from the local library. And I would like then to read more from this book, The Elements of the Religious Life by Reverend William Humphrey S.J., which has a Nika off state by Ricardus McCoy S.J., an imprimatur, Herbertus Cardinalis Vagin, 28th of December 1902, published in London, Thomas Baker, Solo Square, 1903, second edition revised and enlarged. And this second edition does not have the same page numbers as the one Ms. Kiko is using, but it has some very good information. And now let me share some with you from page 90. Religious profession, like every human contract and vows, may be invalid. It may be invalid in as many ways as there are conditions which are necessary in order to the validity of it. Sometimes religious profession may be invalid by the law of nature, and sometimes by ecclesiastical law, sometimes from an internal defect, and sometimes from an external defect. on the part of the religious order, four conditions are required in order to the validity of religious profession. These are pontifical approbation of the community as a religious order. And interrupt text here to remind us what we said on the phone conversation earlier this morning. Francis Shephard certainly could not give pontifical approbation to the community being only a layman, and Bishop Sylvester W. Tryon certainly gave no pontifical approbation, and Paul VI certainly could give no pontifical approbation. Going on with Father Humphrey's book, lawful power in the superior when the name of the order receives the profession. I interrupt the reading from Father Humphrey's book to make the comments that certainly then Francis Shephard cannot receive the profession himself, not being a superior with lawful power, because Francis Shephard was himself suspended and excommunicated. And there are many things that might be spoken about to show that Francis Shephard was suspended and excommunicated. But for now, I'm going to just read from a letter signed Very Reverend Father Dennis Philemon Marie, CMRI, Vicar General, dated Feast of Corpus Christi, June 21st, 1984. This is a six-page letter. That's an insert that explains all the reasons why he had to split with Bishop Shephard. I read now from page 5 of this letter, under the paragraph 4, absolution of an accomplished in sins of impurity. One of the most serious censures in the canon law of the Catholic Church is reserved for a priest who attempts to absolve an accomplished in his sin against the Sixth Commandment. This crime carries a penalty of excommunication, laite sententiae, which is most especially reserved to the Holy See. To incur this penalty, a priest must commit a sin of impurity with some other person and then attempt to hear the confession of that person. If such a crime occurs, the absolution is invalid and the minister incurs the excommunication laite sententiae. I have in my possession a statement sworn under oath from a young man who claims that he was seduced by Bishop Shephard, that he was used by Bishop Shephard for moral purposes, and that afterwards Bishop Shephard heard his confession. In my opinion, and that of the priests and clerics that I consulted, Bishop Shephard clearly has incurred the penalty of this crime. I know from the statements of Bishop Shephard's current aides that some of these young men are currently involved in sins of impurity with him, and I also know for a fact that they are accustomed to confess to Bishop Shephard and not to any other priest. One of these young men told Father Man Benedict that Bishop Shephard told him he may not discuss this matter of confession or in counseling with any priest or superior. And so from this letter I just read of Father Dennis Philemon and me, he clearly points out that Bishop Shephard has attempted to absolve and accomplish in his sins of impurity and thereby was excommunicated. And this excommunication then would have obviously taken place the first time and every time that Francis Shephard attempted this absolution of an accomplished sin. I personally did not know the first time that Bishop Shephard involved in accomplished sin and was excommunicated for this reason, but I reasonably believe it was not long after he was made a bishop. My reasons for believing this are as follows. Father Dennis Pellamini reminded us that Bishop Francis Shephard heard most of the confessions after he was first consecrated, and at that time even Father Clement Kubich was not with the community.